Hey, what's up, guys? This is You Know Who in the Little Saigon Report with my good friend AJ from Florida. It is Tuesday, February. I can't believe it's February already. It's Tuesday, February the 4th, 2020. And today we're going to talk about time travel. Now, so you know, we have an outline we're working off of, and we're certainly going to include that as a reference when we're done in the podcast description. But every once in a while on the Little Saigon Report, we like to do things that maybe aren't too stressful. And before we get too into it, I would just like to say, hey, AJ, how you doing? And is anything new going on with you?
Good morning, Dan. Thank you for having me on the show. In my world, just family things. We've got two young kids, and one was recently under the weather, but it wasn't the coronavirus, so everyone's back on their feet. I got a touch of it myself, but everyone's mending up well and just focused on my metal work. That's what I'm really passionate about. I like to weld and melt metals and try to create different alloys and working on ways to create revenue from it independently without having to work with someone else. So that's what I've been up to. And did you have a good Groundhog's Day?
No, yeah. I mean, every day is Groundhog Day, man.
Yes, sir, it is. Infinite gray. But this should be a real exciting topic. Time travel has always fascinated me and the different aspects of it, whether physically or metaphysically. No better person to dissect it with than Dan from Little Saigon, my friend. So whenever you're ready to jump into it.
Well, before we go too deep into it, I just wanted to mention really quick, I don't really know how to determine how real the whole coronavirus woo-flu thing is. At this point, I'm kind of the mind of just assuming that it could be real, it could be fake, or it could be something in between. I hope people out there are taking precautions. I am not a doctor. And frankly, I don't really, I'm kind of a reckless person in a way. I don't really, you know, I don't take a lot of precautions. So the bad news for me is that if this thing is real, I'll probably get sick. But the good news for you guys is what I've said before, you know, at least there's an Irishman in the coal mine. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Throw the Irishman in the coal mine. And if he's dead, you know, if you put him down the coal mine and if he ends up dead, you know something, don't you?
I hope it doesn't come to that, but I know you would you would do us the honor of sending out that last message, but I'm not worried too much about the coronavirus. I don't have an opinion because I'm with you. It's tough to distill through the news, which is also disjointed, any real facts, but I've got the monkey herpes thing working down here. That was the report you did, the uplifting report on the monkey herpes was in a neighborhood 10 minutes away from my house. So I'm on the lookout. I think this would be interesting to see, and it could be a good weapon for the Zeta Squad enforcers to have the monkey herpes. We could train them with bananas. And I don't think they'd attack beans. I think they might have sympathy on them. But if not, we would have to not have them join the squad. But the coronavirus, I you brought up a great point the other day, and I know you've looked at all the six scenarios, but if this was as bad, I feel personally they would have shut down all travel immediately. And they haven't really done that. It's here or there you hear about it. But I still, they're back chemtrailing my skies today. So air traffic is going on. If it was this global pandemic, I think they would have done more than that. So that's up my two cents on it. But
yeah, well, I kind of agree. Yeah, I kind of agree with that. And I mean, I don't know about how friendly or trainable herpes monkeys are. but they're real, aren't they? They're, you know, some dude in the 30s, you know, thought it would be really cool to take a bunch of these fucking monkeys and put them on an island in Florida. And then lo and behold, the fucking monkeys escape. Isn't
they
that?
Did. Yeah. They did. They've spread. I've been to that. The springs. The springs are very popular in Florida. You go tubing down them. So I've been to that state park. It was probably about 4 years ago. And did see those monkeys. I didn't know they had herpes. That wasn't advertised, but I didn't kiss any of them, so I think I'll be okay.
I think they said it's herpes B, and I'm not sure if herpes B is good or bad, you know?
Yeah, well, that's where I thought of the trick, because everyone's so terrified of herpes that it'd be great if you could train them as a weapon for the Zeta Squad to get our numbers up. There's not much hope with other people.
Well, actually, you have a great idea here, because with a little bit of technology, we could have flying monkeys.
Oh, like, even better.
Could do little
they could be
drones.
Spitting down. They could spit down
well,
on people.
Well, you carry them in drones. You know, you put those drones are getting pretty, you know, sophisticated. Mm-hmm. You put one in a drone and you fly it around. That's going to freak people out.
Yes.
You know. Anyways,
I
don't want to.
I know.
Okay. I'm not going to spend all day on fucking monkeys. It's just, it's such a nice fucking story to lighten the mood to talk about monkeys that have herpes. So, as stated, AJ and I are following an outline. We wanted to do this a few weeks ago, but, you know, the holiday season and the winter season, stuff gets crazy. But we have an outline, and there's a good chance that this is going to be more than one show. In fact, it'll probably be at least two, and it could be more. But the first subject in the outline on the subject of time travel is what the fuck is it? Because I think it's one of those things where, depending upon how you define time travel, you'll probably end up getting closer to whether or not you think it's feasible. What do you think?
Yes, there are a lot of ways to define it, which is why we'll most likely have multiple podcasts here. And for myself personally, I see it as the physical version. Classic would be Hitler and his legendary Die Glocke Bell act, going back and forth through the past and present and future. And then what I'm more interested in personally, because it's feasible, is metaphysically. And just to define metaphysically for the people out there, my definition of it is anything that cannot be defined by the five senses. So whether it's a spiritual feeling or something, just your gut feeling that science has not been able to prove, but you can feel it's there. And I have had some premonitions or dreams that have led me to situations in the future that feel like deja vu, which is one of our topics. But that for me would be the metaphysical side of time travel, which with all the history and all the novels, which we'll talk about and some predictive programming, it seems like someone is able to shift back and forth through the future, whether it's mere mortals or a higher power. It's fascinating to think about. And I also wanted to encourage, Dan, the listeners to email you or leave a comment if there's a particular part of a topic or something that we didn't go into a detail enough, if they have a tangent that we could follow up with on the next show, because this is such an abstract concept, because there is no proven documented record of any time travel that I'm aware of. And the atomic clock, that's very subtle, but any major time travel, that to have the listeners email you or leave a comment on the show would be great to follow up with, because this could go so many places.
Right. Well, I mean, for you, it's just, I think what you're saying is you can look at time travel from the perspective of hard physics or technology. You can also look at it from the perspective of psychology or even, you know, the nature of the mind.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, why do you think time travel is so fascinating to people? Like, why is it such a big feature of fiction? You know, I sent you that link that showed you a list of fictional works that go back a long ways. It was just crazy. And it seems like for hundreds of years, and probably longer, maybe going back. I mean, we think about it, it's in the Bible in a way, but why do you think time travel is so fascinating to people?
I think there's lots of reasons. One that comes to mind is the fear of death. So it's a way to sort of absolve some of those fears by knowing what lies ahead. And if time travel is possible, it just opens up the realm to more than the five senses. And when you go into the dirt, your earth, food for the worms. And so you get another, I wouldn't say insurance policy, but in the back of your mind, for me, it would open that up more if it was proven some way to exist. And as far in literature, it has come up quite often. There's some funny examples of themes that we could talk about in a moment. My favorite example, and one might not even consider this time travel, but the book 1984, how it so accurately depicts, written by Eric Blair, George Orwell, back in 1944 or something.
Yeah, this is where okay, can I pause you for a second?
Yeah, please do. Mm-hmm.
This is where you're talking about predictive programming, right?
Well, I don't know so much if it was predictive programming or could they see the end game ahead of time, or what were they trying to get us channeled to that end game? That's a question I have, because that resonated so much with our actual reality, to me it feels like George Orwell was time traveling more than predictive programming, but it could have been that for sure.
Well, is it time traveling or is it just being really good at seeing the future, being a good futurist?
I wrestle with that, Dan. I think it's potentially. If I had to place a wager, I'm going to go with being able to predict the future based on having some of the strings for the puppets. But I hold the possibility that they can, whoever they is, I don't know, the devil in this world, is able to have some of the end game in their sight. And that might have been an example of it. But I don't, what are your thoughts? Are you 100% sold that they're just on the knowing the future based on they're going to engineer it that way? Or?
Well, I mean, okay, here's where I'm at with this whole issue. I think there's a big difference between, quote unquote, seeing the future and interacting with the past. Okay, I think maybe there are fewer issues of causality with seeing the future because the future's not fixed. I mean, I don't know that we were guaranteed to go down the road we went down so far, but it's certainly the case that when you read George Orwell's 1984 or when you read A Brave New World by Huxley, it seems like these are as much science fiction stories as almost expositional descriptions of a world that we now kind of live in. And it's kind of fucked up because if you read them, it's like, holy crap, did they see the future or were they the ones, or were they people who happened to have connections with people who are controlling the future?
Yes. And that's the common belief is that, yeah, they were part of the Rothschilds or whoever, family doesn't matter. But, and that's how it occurred. And the list you sent me, there was a theme we both noticed, which was women, a gender flip. So
Anno, the year 7603, it's written by a Johann Hermann Vessel. It was published in 1781, you know, so that's a good couple hundred years ago, more. And the main plot is a fairy sends people forward to the year 7603, and it's basically a society, it's a matriarchy, the women rule.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know anything about it, but it almost seems like it's got to be a dystopia, right?
Yeah, but and not a, I'm not a sexist at all, but the roles have definitely shifted, even gotten blurred to where, you know, women have been put on more of a pedestal of late. And whether that was against social engineered, like 1984, Brave New World, or they could see this coming, because I do believe in free will, but you have to exercise your free will, and not many people around me want to do that these days. So it wouldn't have been too hard for them to engineer the whole thing. But it was interesting that back when these books were written, the men did have the upper hand from what we're led to believe in a relationship in the society, and the women were relegated to being moms, but nothing wrong with that either. But now we've got the robots that, you know, they tell us, oh, the robots are coming, the robots are going to take all our jobs. And I challenge anybody who's ever looked at a Roomba in operation to really meditate on, sorry to steal your line, Dan, I love that one, to really meditate on whether or not the robots are going to steal our future. But what happens 100 years from now? Dan, what do you think 100 years from now?
I mean, you already know how I feel about the future. It's a giant question mark for me right now. I mean, from day to day, things are shifting so quickly that I really don't know. I mean, it's a futurist in 2020 is probably going to be wrong. That's what I think right now. I think the probability of certainty is near zero at this point.
Now let's say we go back 100 years in our time machine. You and I are having a conversation and someone is putting out that women are going to be working as CEOs and high level paying jobs, and they're not going to be moms anymore. You and I would probably call that person crazy. So the way things can shift in 100 years, if we're all still here.
Oh, listen, if we are all still here like we are right now, and I know that a lot of people have their own views on this. Me personally, I think odds are if there are humans on Earth 100 years from now, they're going to be struggling to survive. I don't think, you see, this is my view about things like totalitarian societies. Yes, it's true, they're horrific. They're absolutely fucking horrific, but they're not really free. And they're not like a perpetual motion machine. Ultimately, they do wind down. They're not really very successful or vibrant. So even if we entered into some horrible dystopia, you'd have to posit either a massive die-off or some new source of energy. And I just don't know that either one of those is going to lead to the worst case scenario. It's like, I think the worst case scenario might be impossible, but I just don't know.
I'm right there with you. And couldn't guess. And I don't know if there's any current books that you've read that are similar to what they wrote back then of science fiction describing, besides the whole robot thing. But for me, if things were to go super sideways, I recall there were these hearing stories about these plastic collections of materials out in the oceans. And
Yeah.
Have you heard of the giant
plastic, the islands, the plastic islands.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, the plastic.
Yeah, the
islands.
Plastic, yeah. The giant garbage patches. There's mm-hmm. a few of them. So there are these things out there in the oceans called gyres. That's spelled Gulf, Yankee, Romeo, Echo, Sierra, gyres. And a gyre is really just a spinning flow, a spinning kind of turbulence. So it spins in a circle. So, and you can also call it a gear if you want to, because they're kind of like gears, right? But they're called gyres. And in these gyres, they end up collecting, because there's these big vortexes or these gigantic vortexes in the ocean, they end up collecting garbage. And again, this is kind of off the topic of time travel, but I don't know. Should we talk about this or not?
Oh, okay. We can wait till next time. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I didn't want to go
into the future, though. Yeah. Yeah. That's more survival.
The idea is that, Here's the idea. You got all this garbage out there, and certainly nobody likes that. I mean, I don't know anybody who likes the idea that we have these almost like these archipelagos of garbage that are as big as some states in the United States of America. I mean, they're huge. So what if you put together a plan to basically process the garbage? And again, I don't know how easy it would be, but you process the garbage in such a way that you turn it into archipelagos and into basically archipelagos that are designed to survive, a class 5 or 6 hurricane, essentially. I mean, you have to think about this in terms of survivability, right? But imagine mm-hmm. you could build these huge, basically floating islands where people could live out of the garbage that's floating out there. I know that sounds crazy. It does kind of sound crazy, but then again, what are we going to do with all that garbage?
I don't know. Well, is that plasma incinerator? Do you think that's real? Or they can just, I don't know.
Only if you have free money. If you have free energy, you can do anything you want to with garbage, dude. Mm-hmm. If you have free energy, you can simply superheat it. You can superheat it to a plasmatic state. You can put it in a centrifuge and you can pull apart the atoms and you can have every single element removed. And again, it's not a free lunch. You're not getting anything free here. It's just that with free energy, you can do a lot of funky shit. Mm-hmm. Without it, you're kind of stuck dealing with how do you handle a problem without it making you go broke? Because let's be honest here, if we're on this topic for right now, the reason why we got this problem is because we tiger beavers, we clever monkey apes, we love to dump stuff in holes and pretend it'll go away. Well, it doesn't. The shit ends up coming back to haunt us. That's what these giant garbage islands are. there are consequences. And so the question is, what do you do with the consequences? One idea was, what if you could convert them into living spaces for people?
You know? I like that idea. If you get the government to sign off on it,
the other thing is too, would you need the government? Like if you could get a hold of a ship, a big enough ship. Anyways, you know what, dude, I don't want to go into all
of that. Yeah, you're right. This isn't
time anyways, travel. Far as what is time travel, I think what we could say is time travel might be just your mental relationship to the past and the future, and it might be that. It might be something more. On the subject of existence, do you want to go on the next point, or is that mm-hmm. what you think? Okay, so on the subject of existence, all right, does time travel exist? Well, there's something called the Heffel-Keating experiment, and it basically amounted to taking atomic clocks in jets. I think it was the 60s or the 70s, but they brought them up in the jets at high altitude, high speed. They went in both directions around the world with the rotation. I should say, yeah, with the rotation of the Earth and against the rotation. And they did more or less show that time dilation, which is something Einstein predicted, is real. Now, it was fractional, very, very fractional, which means depending upon what they did, they either gained or lost, like, you know, bits and pieces of seconds, not even a whole second. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I read the table. I saw the table. It was nanoseconds.
Nanoseconds. Yeah. So small. That's why they need an atomic clock. It was almost immeasurably small. And also, you know, this is the thing, too. You and I were having a conversation the other day about, and it's sort of related, about carbon dating and the use of isotopes to date things. Mm-hmm. And again, when you're talking about small amounts, you always have the possibility of error. You know what I mean? Like mistakes, error, the fact that our instruments might not be accurate enough to even measure what we're looking at.
Yeah, the atomic clock test is, it's interesting. It's a great idea to prove it. I'm suspect because I have very little trust in the government when they're trying to prove certain things to shatter people's faith. And secondly, we're not going to get into on this podcast, but there's the spin of the Earth has not been proven. Michelson Morley, we spoke the other day about that, failed to prove it and has yet to be proven that I've seen any examples of. So
well, can we just call it controversial? That way we won't get too many people pissed off because there are a lot of people, if you mention this shit, they get pissed off.
Well, no, not anything to go down that road. It's just that test relies on the spin of the Earth, which I just wish someone could give me a good proof of that, and I'd be a very happy camper.
Well, isn't there the pendulum, the frickin' whatchamacallit?
The Foucault
pendulum? Isn't that
That's been debunked. I've looked at that one, definitely, because if that one were... Well, if the Foucault pendulum were to hold, then I should be able to just go up in a hot air balloon and, you know, let the Earth spin beneath my feet. But we're told that the atmosphere moves with us, so the Foucault pendulum would move too. So that's sort of doesn't add up. But this is not that podcast.
But here's what's interesting though about that, the atmosphere issue. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that imply that if you could go up to and you can do this with weather balloons? Wouldn't that imply if you can send a weather balloon up to 100,000 feet that it should start moving relative to the Earth at about 1,000 miles an hour? Shouldn't it? I mean,
it should.
There's virtually no atmosphere. Mm-mm. So you might not be quite 1,000 miles an hour, but it should be pretty close to that, you would think, if we're moving with the atmosphere. It's like what you said about the Foucault pendulum. If it's real, it should have other corollaries.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not real, it won't. That's the thing about a lot of confirmational tests, and it's a worthy conversation before we go too far. When it comes to controversial science, and I think that I want to say that it wasn't Arthur C. Clarke. It was another guy. I always forget his name. He did the Cosmos series.
Carl Sagan.
Carl Sagan.
And years ago, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, he once said that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of think, yeah, that's true. You know, if you're going to tell me you can travel through time, I don't want to see one validation. I want to see, you know, a lot of validations. It's kind of like confirmation of tests. You know, some of these tests that have been done throughout history are so exotic, like this Haffel-Keating experiment, that who confirmed it? Like who went and did the test the second time? Did the Soviets do it? Did the French go do it? I mean, who did the second test? You know?
That's a great point.
I'm not an expert. So if there's someone out there who wants to email me a link to the complete history of the confirmation of time dilation, feel free. I will tell you that space and mass dilation, at least according to the experimental results, has been confirmed in accelerators. Now, AJ, do you know what an accelerator is?
Are we talking CERN type?
Yeah, CERN types.
Yeah.
Okay, so why don't you give our audience just a basic overview of how an accelerator works?
With the...
If that's okay.
Yeah, the linear kind? Is that...
Either. They work basically the same way.
I'm not trying to
put you on the spot.
I
can step in here real quick.
Yeah, you better take this one.
The bottom line is this. I was putting you on the spot as being a jerk, okay?
No. I said yes, but I'm familiar with them. I'm not because the issue is I can't go do it myself, so I do read the articles about these things, you know.
I was same thing,
but yeah. But no, please go for it.
I'm a jerk. Anyways,
far from it.
Okay. So accelerators use magnetic fields to push particles faster and faster. I guess that's a nice way of putting it. And these fields are pulsed and they go in a revolution if they're on a circular type accelerator. And if they're linear, they just go in a straight line. A lot of accelerators for a long time were linear. And I think there's still one or two operating. Like I said, I think that Argonne National Laboratories might still have a linear accelerator. The problem with linear accelerators, though, is probably pretty obvious. The racetrack has a beginning and end. And you're dealing with effects that are recorded near the speed of light. So something like CERN is basically a racetrack for particles. And you can pump these particles with energy. You can get them going faster and faster so that you get to the point that you have a proton. I think they're pushing protons there. But you get a proton going like 99% the speed of light. And then you collide a couple protons together, and that's kind of like, hey, what makes up a proton? I'm kind of oversimplifying, but that's kind of like why they do it. They accelerate these particles. And here's the thing. When you accelerate a particle, according to Einstein, its mass increases. So all of a sudden, something that's very difficult to see becomes easier to see. On the other hand, what are you seeing? Are you seeing nature, or are you seeing nature on steroids? You know, it's a whole, there's a lot of questions about accelerators and these experiments. They're controversial, but again, they're given as proofs of Einstein's mass and space dilation. Like, hey, accelerators would not work if time and space dilation did not exist.
Yeah, that was a great explanation. And I wanted, while you were going through it, I was thinking that I believe that they have these facilities and they're doing experiments. I would put out that perhaps they're looking at more of the plasma effects, because there are so many interesting things you can do with plasma and magnetism. And, you know, they'll call in the proton, that's what they're speeding up, but it could also be an aspect of the ether. If the ether has a mass to it, if you were to accelerate it, that would increase your force and would give you these potentially same effects. And it's tough for me as a layman to have any true insight on what's going on with those protons, because you have to take their word for it, like how they claimed recently to discover the gravitational waves. Well, that's great. They said they did it, but how do we really know? And what type of applications is this going to have to our real world? I mean, if you look up E equals MC squared, what that's actually used for with brass tacks physics, you don't find a whole lot. So except for situations like this, but what does that have to do with my microwave working or my water being clean? And that's, if they can find some free energy device, and of course, would they give it out? Not likely. But if they could do something practical with these contraptions, it would mean more to me than to prove Einstein right. because that's a whole nother can of worms. But if that's where I'm at. What are your thoughts on plasma and the magnetism?
Okay, well, before I jump into that, I'm just going to say this really quick. If you listen to or you read the reports coming out of CERN, what they're interested in is studying, essentially, they call it the Large Hadron Collider now. They're interested in studying essentially the God particle, you know, the Higgs boson particle, which, you know, they want to prove that it exists because they believe if they can prove that it exists, a big feature of cosmology and a big feature of what's called the grand unification theory. And listen, for those of you out there who don't know what grand unification theory is, it's one of the reasons why, at least according to what they say, they spend all this time at CERN. For many, many decades, ever since Einstein, there have been the development of theories in physics that don't quite fit. For example, you said, you know, I have a microwave. Well, frankly, the physics you need to make your microwave work, that physics existed more than 100 years ago. Like, yeah, we learned to do things that were more advanced, like the electronics inside. But the ability to generate radio wave signals, that was something that was invented in the late 19th century. And really, what you have inside of your microwave is a radio wave generator. You know, it generates a microwave. It generates a very, very small wave. And there's a reason for that. That small wave will cause water molecules to vibrate and you get heat, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. That's great, you know. But you're right, though. The physics required to make a microwave work, that physics was more or less solid in 1900. I'm not saying the technology was all there, but the physics was there. You follow me so far?
Yeah, they were doing all that work with Nikola Tesla. He published papers. You can look up his patents. They're wonderful. He had a radio-controlled boat, an RC boat, little boat, back in 1901, I believe, somewhere then. And you can look up the patent. He has his handwriting. It's beautiful. Yeah, I agree with you. They were all over this. Induction coils, yeah, frequencies.
But then it comes to something like, for example, relativity. And this is where we're getting back to grand unification theory. And even though, hey, listeners, even though we're taking some side roads here when it comes to time travel, some of this is important for purposes of conversation, right? So you have Einstein's theory of relativity, which requires a lot of advanced technology to prove. Would you agree? Mm-hmm. You need,
yes.
You can't prove Einstein with the technology of the year 1900. You really can't. I mean, all you can do is say, okay, he has an explanation for Michelson-Morley, but how do you prove his explanation? You can't really do it in 1900. And the same thing applies for quantum mechanics. There's a lot of things that quantum mechanics implies that people say is inferred or implied or you can derive as being true, but it's the kind of experimentation that ordinary people could never do. We could never do it. You and I could not go build a hobo accelerator and we could try, and the most likely outcome is we would end up with more herpes monkeys.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm just saying, dude.
That's good or bad.
Grand unification theory.
Great.
Grand unification theory is the goal. It is the purpose of GUT is to take relativity theory, quantum physics, and Newtonian physics and resolve them together. Does that make sense? So that they all make sense. We no longer have the shit where Einstein said, you know, this quantum physics looks spooky, blah blah blah. No more of these qualitative words about spookiness. We can show why things are true. For example, like the photon issue we talked about the other day. Is a photon a particle or is it a wave? Well, standard thing to say today is yes, it's both. It's depending upon how you observe a particle of light or light, it can either seem like a particle or a wave. You know, it's that's the thing though. Grand unification theory is a lofty goal, and the premise behind it is that there are these conflicts. Now, you asked me, Dan, you said, Dan, what do you think about the plasma or electric universe? Is that kind of like where you're going with that basic, like, what do I think of that?
And if you want to couch that with, could it be that the reason the three different fields do not align is because there's issues with some of them. And now they're going to do patchwork. And yes, with the plasma and electromagnetic universe to tie everything together. Because if you look, one of the issues with quantum mechanics, Dan, is that they never define what a field is. They talk about a field. But what is the field? What is it made of? And
well,
this is where Nikola Tesla would say
ether. This is what they'll say. I know. And listen, I stopped you, but you know what they'd say a field is, AJ? Mm-hmm. They would say a field is a probability field.
A field of – it still has to be something.
That's what they say.
A field of water or
– It's a field of likelihoods. Like if you – okay, so let's say I have an electron orbiting an atom, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've got the nucleus of an atom and I've got an electron. Quantum mechanics would say it's useful to talk about the electron field, but it's not very useful to talk about the electron as a particle, because at any given moment, if you try to see it from the wrong perspective, you're going to miss out on the rest. It's sort of like, depending upon what you choose to look at, you're going to miss the rest. That's one of these things. The observation, you know, the word observation seems like a small word for a lot of people, the word observation. But for people in quantum physics, observation is a critical word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a big part of how you say something is true or false is about how you are able to interpret it, to record it, to analyze it. And if you shift your perspective, all of a sudden, something that you thought was one thing becomes something else. Now, if you ask me, and I think this is where you're going to go, Tesla rejected a lot of this. Let's just get that out of the way. Tesla believed in what I would call good old-fashioned science.
Mm-hmm.
He believed in experimentation, and he believed in physical validation, which means that you can have all of the scientific theories and all the formulas and all the fucking books you've written, but if you cannot conduct a repeatable experiment, Tesla would say, I call bullshit.
And that's, yeah, and I go with that as well, because some math is great, but it's real easy to manipulate, because you can start with 2 = 2 and start throwing variables on both sides and make this convoluted system and add other equations. And it could look like stuff Einstein had on the back of his chalkboard, but it's really just 2 = 2, and you can cover things up in there. Just like, for example, the sun and the moon appear to be the same size. Oh, well, it's because they happen to be the distance is 93 million miles away, and it's that times the moon is that much times smaller than the sun. So they're able to back their way into it, and that's how I see Einstein's relativity is a way of coverage for things they couldn't prove. And it's okay to just say we don't know. I wish they would. I wish they don't have to have an answer for everything. I don't have an answer. So it seems with the unified and all that they're trying to cover their tail with the quantum field. And yes, the charge would be important on a field back to the electrons. But as it pertains to having its mass, they say, correct me if I'm wrong, but the electron doesn't have a mass, right?
Well, no, the electron does have a tiny amount of mass, I think. It does. The neutron has a little bit of mass. The proton, essentially, I think mass exists in every particle, and depending upon how you look at light, light could also be considered to have mass. There are experiments where light behaves like something that has mass. But you're right, it's very, very small. It's completely small. And again, all of, we're talking about things that neither one of us has ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen an electron. I've never seen an atom. I believe they exist because I've been told they exist. And there appear to be scientific and technological outcomes that would seem to be less likely if they didn't exist. I don't know how else to put it.
I agree with you. And as a child, I was all on board with everything and looked, I don't know if I looked up to it, but you know, E=mc², and you have, I'd say, reverence for it. Sort of like the Pledge of Allegiance to the Star Spangled Banner. But when you start to see all the lies and you want to question things and you dig into it a little bit, that some of the topics we're talking about, maybe perhaps not everyone's looked at, but if they're interested, I encourage them to dabble a bit, and you'll find that there's not a lot to substantiate on your own end of here's the proof of it, like Nikola Tesla would look for. And so that's where my skepticism comes from. But I'm open to anything. I just want to be able to use the scientific method and be able to repeat it or watch someone repeat it for me if I don't have the equipment. Put it on video and just throw it on YouTube. Let me watch. But there's a lot of secrecy around the nuclear. Not this totally different topic, but it's frustrating. So that's where my skepticism comes from. But Dan, you take it from here. Where do you want to go?
Well, no, I mean, we're still on this basic question. And point two is, has time travel been proven to exist? And I think this is a good conversation because we're talking about the field of physics that would allow for that. Okay. And before we go to the next point, I would say, if you believe in the Haffel-Keating experiments, if you have faith in the interpretations of accelerator results, then I would say travel into the future has been proven. Would you agree with that? If you agree with the experimental results of these tests and what they're inferencing, like if you think that their interpretation is correct, it's not just that the data is correct, but the interpretation is correct, would you agree that they've proven traveling faster through time forward?
Yes, with those assumptions, which is a lot like evolution. There's a bunch of assumptions you got to go for first.
Well, and dude, I don't have an atomic clock.
I know.
I don't have a fucking high-speed jet rocket. I don't have a half-ass hobo accelerator. And if I had any of those things, I'd rather have monkeys with herpes.
Me too. Yeah, Dan, logically, yes, if A to B to C is true, if A and B are true, then yes, C is true here. I question, the A and B, but that's where I'm at. So for me, it has not been proven to my ability to check it out for myself.
Now,
but I do, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the one thing I think I can say definitively, and I think you'd agree with me, other than science fiction and conspiracy theories, I don't think there's ever been a paper published to prove that going backwards in time is possible.
No, I have not seen that.
You know, there's a lot of conspiracy theory around that. And it's one of those things where we can talk about a little bit of this here, too, because this applies to separate points in this conversation. But it's like the Mandela effect. Some people would say, and before we go too deep into the Mandela effect, because we're going to talk about it at different points during this conversation, including podcasts on time travel to come, right, in the future.
Yeah. Ooh.
The Mandela effect. Let me hold on. I'm going to double check. What year was it they tell us that Nelson Mandela died? Let's see.
Yeah. I think 2000.
Nelson Mandela.
12?
Nelson Mandela died in 2013 here. But you said 2012.
That's close.
Or 2003.
Yeah.
No, he died in 2013. That's what it says.
That's what they said.
Hutana State. Yeah. But if you look up the Mandela effect, and this is where, let's do that really quick because I want to look it up. There are people who believe that he died at a different point in time. Like basically, he died in the 1980s. That's what people believe. A lot of people believe he died in the 1980s.
Yeah, and my memory is not the best for things that do not have patterns. So random facts that, like when in Nelson Mandela, doesn't have too much implication in my life. I would not be a good person to go for on that, but I do recall him having died previously. I don't think I'm a Mandela effect person whatsoever, but Dan, do you, what are your thoughts? Just him alone, because I thought he did die earlier than 2012. I only got to 2013 because I've looked into the Mandela effect, but.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about some of the Mandela.
Maybe effect define is, it first. Yeah.
It's called, okay. So the Mandela effect is the following. And actually the problem with the Mandela effect is it doesn't have a really good definition, but I'll give you mine. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you mine. In fact, I need to do something here while we're talking about really quick, but I will give you mine. The Mandela effect is the belief among some people that we have within the human population memories of events in the past that are in conflict. For example, you remember Publishers Clearinghouse?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what's his name? He worked with Johnny Carson. Let's see. Publishers Clearinghouse. It was Publishers Clearinghouse, wasn't it?
It was. Where they gave away, they go up to people's
Clearinghouse. And what's his name would hand out awards?
Mm-hmm.
Winners.
Schmuck.
That schmuck.
Ugh. Yep.
Johnny Carson. Carson Mandela. That's Do you remember blah, blah, blah? Come on. What was his name? What was that guy's name? Johnny Carson.
Oh, I don't know this one.
Johnny Carson's sidekick. Great. Ed McMahon.
Ed McMahon. Stole my childhood with those fantasy
Ed McMahon.
Tales.
Hold on, dude. I should have been prepared. This is my problem. Okay. Ed McMahon. The Curious Case of Ed McMahon and the Publisher's Clearinghouse. Okay. Never worked. Okay. It says Ed McMahon never worked. He was a spokesman for what was it? What does it say? American fucking. Oh God, what's it saying here? Ed McMahon did not work for. He was a spokesman for American Family Publishers. Never left the studio to ambush families. But I swear to God, I remember him doing it. Do you too.
I really, because they ran those commercials all the time, and Ed McMahon. He had that. You know, that's a pretty catchy name. And yeah, there's a bunch of Mandela effects when you go through that. I'm not 100%.
Well, but what about the fact that I have a hard time remembering it now, but maybe 5 or 10 years ago, I would have had an easier time remembering it. Now, so here's the thing about the Mandela effect. There is a belief that we remember things differently. It's like, whatchamacallit, not Cocoa Puffs, but there's been like cereals, like people remember cereals a certain way.
A good one for me, Dan, did the Monopoly Man have a monocle or not?
I thought he had a monocle.
Me too. He doesn't. Look it up. Well, he doesn't now. So.
So here's the thing. The Mandela effect is the belief that this is happening and it's not just false memory syndrome. That's number one. And number two, it is also the belief that maybe either this is happening. There are two interpretations of this. One interpretation is this is the multiverse and people are accidentally interacting with other universes. As you know, and I will say probably before this series is over, I don't believe in the multiverse as it's currently described, which means different universes that exist.
I do not either.
But that doesn't mean I don't believe in quantum physics, okay? I just think that the principle in quantum physics, superposition, that leads people to the multiverse has more than one interpretation. So it's the thing about science, unless you can show something in very material terms, it's a lot of fucking opinions on how you interpret things. You know what I mean?
I agree with you, and I do believe in quantum mechanics. I don't think it's been described to us all the way or properly, and there's still a lot of work to be done, which is what's fascinating.
Okay.
Things
so
left to be explored.
One interpretation of the Mandela effect. I'm sorry for interrupting you, AJ.
No.
Okay, yeah. I hope that I'm trying to do better this time.
Go with the Mandela effect. I was rambling. Come on, Dan.
No, I'm a son of a bitch. Anyways, no. One interpretation of this is that we're seeing the multiverse, okay? Mm-hmm. Another interpretation is that someone's been going back in time and fucking with time.
Yes, that's where it ties into time travel. That's another one. And the third I've heard is that, well, I lean towards this one, that the powers that be are just fucking with us and making these little changes. Because if you notice, all the Mandela effects come from either brands of cereal or Monopoly Man or when someone died, all of which is controlled by the powers that be.
Okay,
to make
so you're
those
saying,
little changes.
Oh, okay, so you're saying they're not going backwards in time. They're just editing current materials and fucking with us.
Yeah, I don't know why, but it's working, I guess, if that's what they're doing. But I would love it to be the glitch in the Matrix type thing with the spooky action, quantum entanglement. That would be really cool. But what are your thoughts on the three options?
The multiverse option, if you believe in God, I don't think you can believe in the multiverse.
Yeah.
I think the multiverse is appealing to people. It used to appeal to me, too, because it seemed like the perfect get-out-of-jail-free card. And it's one of the reasons why, I don't know how familiar you are with the guy, his last name's Krauss, Dr. Krauss or whatever, but he's one of these big sort of atheists who will talk about the multiverse as a way to deal with the problem of how did life come to be. So if you've studied the issue of how life came to be, stuff kind of works once you have bacteria. But before bacteria, stuff doesn't make any sense at all. When I was going through biology, they told us it was called Oh, God, what was the stupid name? Symbiosis. Here was the theory of how life began I was taught in biology class back in the 80s. A long time ago, about, I don't know, let's say a billion, 2 billion, 3 billion years ago, whatever, there were a bunch of very complicated chemical compounds. And for whatever reason, they decided to start working together or whatever, or they accidentally congealed and they started behaving in a way, and that led to something, and maybe along came a cell membrane and wrapped itself around it. So as you can tell, the problem with explanation of life is less about what happens once you have bacteria, and it's more about how the fuck do you even get bacteria?
Like, well, where did all the things come from before?
Because
that,
bacteria are amazing. The more you learn about them, they're amazing. They are the simplest life form, and they are fucking intriguing as fuck. And how the fuck do you get them from nothing? Well, yeah,
I was going to say, you've been educating me on the bacteria lately, and I agree, with enough time and bacteria, perhaps we could end up here with billions of years. But Dan, you're going to go back to where the bacteria come from.
Well, perhaps. Here's the thing. According to Krauss and people like Krauss, the multiverse could be an explanation. Like, yeah, life is extremely unlikely given one chain of causality. But what people like Lawrence Krauss and others would say is, but it's not one chain of causality. It's an infinite number of chains. It's an infinite number of possibilities, and they interact. So according to Krauss, you could have had a universe where life developed, and then we're just dealing with its leftovers.
Oh, now, wait, hold on, Dan. Where'd that universe come from?
Arguments are stupid. And
these atheists, they got to watch them. They're tricky.
There has never, in my opinion, been a good argument either for or against God or for or against the universe in certain ways. There's never been one. You go back to St. Thomas Aquinas, or even before that. But if you go to St. Thomas Aquinas, he has a lot of really smart proofs for God, and the problem is none of them work.
Well, you've talked about this before, but I don't think there has been or ever will be a proof for God. That's where the faith comes in. But if you want to look in terms of likelihoods, you know, something coming from nothing or a creator, I'm all day going with a creator. But that, because you can't have something come from nothing, no matter how many multiverses you have, you still have to have an original.
Well, that's the problem, is that life as we understand it right now, not just bacteria, but life as we understand it, seems to exist on a relatively narrow margin. Okay? The Earth has a really good orbit around the sun. We have a moon that acts as kind of a defender, like in football, you know, like an offensive line or whatever. So we have a moon that acts as our offensive line. We have a electromagnetic field that blocks radiation and particles that would hurt us and harm us. And you can go further. There's water here. There's every element we would need for life.
Yeah, it's pretty perfect, isn't it?
It's pretty fucking perfect. So yeah. The likelihoods. But again, one interpretation of the multiverse allows them to say, well, yes, it's perfect, but it's still just one universe in an infinitude of universes. And there could be cross-fertilization. I mean, there are people who believe that bacteria might be small enough that the energies required to move between universes would be satisfactory, so that ordinary transfer of energy between universes could, in theory, move bacteria or viruses between universes.
Yeah,
it's an interaction.
Dan, can I ask you a quick question, a little thought experiment on this idea that, with enough time and enough universes, we could end up here. Do you think, I believe this is an atheist, that they would say, well, if we gave a monkey enough time, it could learn to read the dictionary or spell every word in the dictionary, something like that. Do you think that's possible, though? Because that's where it really hits the atheist in the false pocket, because you're assuming things that are going to happen with enough time that will never, ever happen, like a monkey reading Shakespeare, or writing Shakespeare is what they say. And that will never happen. Yeah. Not a monkey. Not even the herpes monkeys are going to write Shakespeare. Well, Dan, I'm sorry. It's not going to happen.
Listen.
Let them bang on a keyboard all day. They will never write Shakespeare. For billions and billions of years, a monkey will never write Shakespeare. So and that's just Shakespeare. We're not talking about making bacteria. So there's so many things they like to extrapolate out with their time. They love that time because it can just open your imagination up, but you're not imagining what actually needs to happen in that time, like monkeys writing Shakespeare. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it is dazzling. when a cosmologist talks about billions and billions of years, you know, mm-hmm. and they talk about things that have happened and how we're so certain, like we are so certain that the Earth is roughly 5 billion years old, plus or minus. They're very certain of that. Yeah, plus or minus, not the exact moment it came to exist, but they're fairly certain. They're fairly certain they know how the universe came to exist. I mean, the Big Bang Theory is still the primary theory. And this is where I want to circle back to that question you had about, well, Dan, what do you think about the electric universe and the plasma universe? Is it okay if I talk about that for a second?
It's a perfect time.
Well, so for me, it's an issue of cosmology, too. And the problem is that I have not, as of now, adopted a single cosmology. I've accepted the possibility that there's more than one cosmology that could be true. There are people who believe, and actually, I forget the name of the guy, but I think he might have been a Jesuit. I'm not a big fan of Jesuits. But there was a Catholic theoretician who proposed what he called the plasma model of the universe. And in his model, there was no Big Bang because the universe has always existed. Like, it's always constantly destroying parts of itself. It's always constantly creating parts of itself. So there is no beginning, there is no end, and then that kind of fits with certain, you know, religious philosophies anyways. You know, the idea that it's always been here. There are people who believe that. And I am sympathetic to that perspective, okay? I am sympathetic to that. I would also say that I am sympathetic to the Big Bang Theory just because there have been people doing research on the subject. They do have things like the recording of background radiation noise, stuff like that. Sympathetic, but I'm not convinced. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Sympathetic, not convinced. And then there are people who say, you know, the universe is electric. And this is similar to the plasma theory, because the mm-hmm. plasma people and the electric people, they tend to cross over. And the electric universe people, they're not as focused on how did the universe begin. They're more interested in what can we learn about right now. Mm-hmm. So for them, everything's electrical. And so when they look at the solar system, for example, they don't see the solar system a way, you know, a Newtonian gravitation-obsessed person would. They see the solar system in terms of electrical charge. And in fact, they describe things like comets in terms of electrical charge. I don't know. I don't know, dude. I will say that, I feel like I totally went away from your basic question there, but...
No, you did. You tied in because it was about CERN and plasma, which I see plasma and electricity one and the same. It's just a form... The plasma would be like an electric state of matter. I'm using that as a phrase.
Actually, that's a good description of it, yeah. Though. I, you know what somebody called plasma? You know what a professor called plasma to me once?
What's that?
He called it electric soup.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, that's what I was going. You know, I like that better.
Because essentially, when you heat these atoms hot enough, the electrons get sheared away.
Mm-hmm. And really interesting things can happen.
Well, you basically got a soup that sort of almost separates between positive and negative charges. It's really weird. And you're right. Really strange things can happen. It is an exotic state of matter. It's why it's, you know, to go over the states of matter, there's solid, there's liquid, there's gas, and there's plasma.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the four states of matter. And plasma, as a state of matter, has only been studied for the most part in the last century or so, but really it's a very exotic situation. It's where, you know, they're doing fusion research today. It's what the work they do. When we, you know, when we talk further in further episodes and talk about the Glock, the Bell, the German Bell project worked with heavy plasmas, supposedly worked mm-hmm. with plasmas involving mercury, which would be a very heavy plasma when you consider that the plasmas that they work with in fusion are basically hydrogen plasmas, you know, very light plasmas, relatively speaking. So again, it's one of those things where here's the deal. I don't believe that even they would say they have ever proven that going backwards in time is possible. But I do think we have to talk about the Mandela effect, and we do have to talk about traveling backwards, because that's a big part of the mystique. Even if it's not possible, would you agree that a big part of the mystique of time travel is this romantic idea that I can go back to Cleopatra or some fucking shit like that, or kill Hitler? I can go back and shoot Hitler in the back of the head.
Yes, yes. Oh, that, or you can go back to when you were a teenager and ask that girl out that you were too scared to at the time. Things yeah, like that.
And
but yeah.
And that's the thing. And we're going to talk about that later too. But that's where, you know, when you brought up earlier, we were talking about what is time travel. And you said, well, Dan, I'd like to focus on the mental aspect of it. That's critical because, and I would even say, you know, if there was a quantum physicist on the line with us, he might even agree, because the observational feature of time travel is really important. It is really important. It's like, it is interesting to talk about doing things like killing Hitler, for example, or asking that girl out. But wouldn't it be interesting just to observe?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be interesting?
Fascinating.
Just to be able, yeah. Yeah. So anyways, I don't believe anybody has ever shown that traveling backwards in time is possible. I will say there's a really weird experiment.
You read my mind. The Philadelphia one?
Not that one. That,
another.
Before we go, you know what? You're going to talk about that one next, if that's okay. Do you feel comfortable talking about the Philadelphia experiment a little bit?
I think that was the government one, right, with the ship?
Well, that was was basically the Montauk experiment during World War II.
Thank you, yeah. Now, you're better at going through the definitions. I can recall them, but which one were you going to talk about? There's another. Which experiment were you going to reference?
Oh, God, I think I even lost it. It was on the tip of – I was right there.
That's okay.
It wasn't Philadelphia. Oh, okay. So early 90s, and I'm going to leave it to my listeners to look this up. There was actually a Nova episode on PBS back in the early 90s that covered this. But back in the early 90s, there was a professor, a researcher in Denmark, I think at the University of Copenhagen, but I could be wrong. And he was working with something called photon tunneling, okay? Mm-hmm. If a photon hits a barrier, which means a barrier that's not transparent, according to quantum mechanics, it has a probability of existing on the other side of that barrier. But it's just a probability. That's the part that's boring. The part that's not so boring is that it will, according to the theory, move across that distance instantaneously, which means technically, even though it only has a probability of existing on the other side of the barrier, it's going to get there faster than the speed of light. You follow me so far?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if I have a photon that moves at the speed of light, again, Gordon Einstein, it's always moving at the speed of light. According to quantum tunneling, it can move faster in a way, but it's only random. It's only random. So that even if it does do this, there's really no way to be sure. Well, there was this researcher in Denmark, and I think it was the early 90s. He was using a maser, which is a microwave laser. It's like a laser, but it projects microwaves. He was using a maser to basically broadcast, I think, Beethoven's Fifth at 1.3 times the speed of light. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because Einstein's equations don't make a lot of sense at certain points. This is another thing that's interesting about Einstein's equations. They stop making sense for certain fields of numbers. Like for certain numbers, things get negative. So, yeah, anyways, this is supposed to be impossible. Like it might be possible for a photon to make it across that barrier instantaneously in a random way. But you're not supposed to be able to transmit information faster than the speed of light. That's supposed to be impossible. Now, that experiment is really controversial, dude. It's so controversial that you'll find more articles debunking it in a way. Not really debunking it, because it's a real experiment, but explaining it away as an anomaly, as not interesting. But when I first heard about it, I thought, holy crap, that's interesting, because technically speaking, according to Einstein, and according to relativity theory, if you can move faster than the speed of light, then you can do something before the universe says you could have done it, which means technically you've gone backwards in time. Okay? Does that make sense?
I'm following. Yeah, that's
now,
I had not heard of that one.
Well, it's a controversial. Let me look it up real quick, because that way I don't sound like I'm bullshitting here.
And the Montauk, I'll just do that while you're looking it up. I recall they basically had a bunch of sailors on a ship, and they hit them with some electromagnetics, not a maser, not that intense. And allegedly they went forward in time and then came back using some, and they were all disheveled and some of them died. But if you look up the incident, the Philadelphia Montauk, it's questionable as to verifying that it did or did not happen. But it's a fun fairy tale, perhaps.
Yeah, so I found one link that covers this. and I'm going to put this link in the notes, and then once I update it.
Good, good. And remember, to all the if listeners have any feedback or thoughts on anything we've covered so far, or topics to go for the next time, because I can't, I don't know what the clock
so
is.
Can I read the summary on this superluminal tunneling story? Since 1992, experimental evidence of superluminal, that's faster than light signals, are causing much excitement in the physical community and the media. Superluminal signal velocity and zero-time tunneling was first observed in an analog tunneling experiment with microwaves. Like I said, recently the conjectured zero-time electron was claimed to be observed in ionizing helium. I'm not sure how to interpret that. Man, I'm a computer programmer, not a physicist.
The FTS, plasma, right? Sorry.
Yeah, whatever, you know plasma? What I mean? Yeah, yeah, well, ionizing helium, it's one man's plasma, maybe.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the FTL signal velocity was reproduced with infrared light and with various tunneling barriers in several laboratories. So this has been reproduced. However, even with this background, many members of the physics community did not accept the superluminal signal velocity interpretation. Well, why would they?
Yeah.
Crazy. I'm glad I put the link in there, and I'm glad I brought it up, because this is a crazy-ass story. Again, quantum physics said that, yes, let's say I had a barrier. Like, let's just say I had a solid barrier bricks, and mm-hmm. I fired a very low-energy infrared laser at it, one side of it. Quantum physics says some of those photons from the laser will instantly arrive at the other side. However, it's random. And then there's this guy who's sending an analog signal, basically Beethoven's fifth, okay? And if you listen to it, if you actually listen to it, it's a little broken up, but you can tell it's Beethoven's fifth. According to, that's not random. You see what I'm getting at?
I gotcha.
That's not random. And it also means that if you did non-analog, which means if you did digital, you probably could take care of the noise problem. And then all of a sudden you're sending digital signals backwards in time. Now, the problem is that to really use this, you would need a barrier. You need a barrier so thick that it wouldn't be meaningful to design. I joked about it once, like, and this was just a joke, but I did this entry on a blog of mine years ago that if you could somehow create crystalline lead, like super crystalline lead, and then wind it, basically have a very small, we're talking about almost nanoscale wire, and wind crystalline lead to the distance of, let's say, 5 or 6 times, like, let's say you did it for, if it's 300,000 miles, let's say you did roughly 10 million miles of this wind. So what you can do is buy yourself about 20 to 30 seconds, okay? Which means that you could theoretically send a signal backwards in time 20 seconds. Well, fuck, if you could do something like that, think about Wall Street. Okay, think about working for Goldman Sachs, and you have a computer trading algorithm, and now you can have 20 seconds on everybody else.
Yeah, that'd be better than any Bloomberg terminal.
It's fucked up, though, because this is also, so listeners, guess what? Even though our first episode is almost over, these are topics we're going to talk about. You know, this idea of the time radio, it's a weird topic, but it's more feasible than sending energy backwards or forwards in time, way more feasible than, say, sending a person, because the physics is accessible. You know, you're not talking about somebody who weighs 200 pounds. You're talking about particles that essentially they have mass, but it's so small that it's negligible. Anywho.
That's a good teaser. Dan, real quick, on that topic, why'd you choose the lead wire?
I had this weird idea. Like, I'll send you.
Okay.
I can remember.
Post it to the.
I'll try to remember to post it the next time. But it was
That's interesting.
Back in 2012, 2013, I was getting really burnt out on all the fucking bullshit within the markets, and we all do. We all get sick of it. After the flash crash 10 years ago, it was one bullshit story after another. So I thought, you know what? If it's all bullshit and it's all going to be schemed, wouldn't it be interesting to build a time radio? Like, wouldn't this be a great idea for some shitty ass crony Wall Street company to spend billions of, because they got billions of bucks, dude. So if I had billions of bucks, and again, this idea of using crystalline lead, it'd be super cool. So the idea is you've got this wind of crystalline lead, a tiny winding wire in a coil that's roughly the distance of, let's say, 3 to 4 million miles. I know this is impossible. And then you super cool it in like probably liquid, probably liquid helium. And then what you do is you have, and this is where things get like, this is way too speculative, dude. What you do is you have to have an X-ray laser, but we don't have those yet, but you have to have an X-ray laser or a gamma ray laser. And we don't have those either. And
the maser, can we use that? A maser?
We use a laser, but the idea is to use a high energy laser, a laser with so much energy that if you shoot it into crystalline lead, it will act as the perfect barrier, but it will also act as a racetrack so that instead of it being a linear crossing of a barrier with random or non-random probability, instead you'd be putting the photon on kind of a pseudo racetrack. So you're tricking it in a way. You're also able to basically take advantage of the fact that the distance it's traveling isn't a few feet, but maybe a few million miles. It's pseudo because it's basically treating the crystalline lead as a kind of weird ass quantum racetrack. And dude, honestly, this shit's total fucking science fiction bullshit.
This is good if we had that much
any chance in hell. No, it'll come up again because I do think the time radio, based upon this experiment with superluminal velocity, it isn't a joke any longer. It isn't like a could we do it? I think there's a way to do it. And the next subject in our next podcast, the beginning of it, we're going to talk about a weird way to think about time travel. And that has to do with what is now. You know, what is this moment we're in? Is the moment that AJ and I and you are in, assuming you were here, but you're not, you're listening. But is this
future
moment? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Is this moment an infinitesimal moment, a mathematically infinitesimal point that moves along, a line we call time? Or is it really messier than that? Is it foggier than that? Is now, the moment we call now, bigger than just now, but more like plus or minus so many seconds, or even hours or days? What if the footprint of the present, this is my point, AJ, and this will be the first topic for the next podcast, but what if the footprint of the present, the now, is bigger than just this moment, but it's actually a little bigger? It's not infinitely big, but what if in fact the now is 12 hours in front and 12 hours behind, you know? So this is and again, I don't want to get too deep into this.
Yeah, let's leave it there, but that's a really interesting topic. I had never thought of that before until you brought it up to me about a week ago and got my wheels spinning. So I cannot wait to jump off on that next time we do the podcast, part two.
Before we go, I want to give a quick summary on the Philadelphia experiment. Okay, and this is what I know. Dude, honestly, this is one of those experiments that's shrouded in so much bullshit. What the fuck do any of us really know?
Mm-hmm. Aaron? Yes.
This is what I think I know. It was an experiment that happened with the United States military. I think it was a destroyer or a cruiser. So it was basically a big military ship. And the idea was to use basically radar and rotating magnetic fields to hide it, to shield it. That was the idea, to visually shield it, to make it invisible on the water. That was the quote-unquote official description of the experiment, was to essentially make the battleship or cruiser invisible. Does that make sense so far?
A cloaking device.
A cloaking device, right? And the idea was that if you had strong enough magnetic fields and you could control them, you could either reflect light or you could cause light to curve around an object, almost like refracting it through glass. Again, this is like 1943, 1944. What did they really know about the universe in 1943? I don't know, dude. They knew enough to build an atom bomb, but they didn't know enough to know they probably shouldn't have, right? So I don't know. But one interpretation of this experiment is that it may have been about that, but it went sideways. And that what they ended up doing was producing so much electromagnetic energy under such an exotic condition. Like they probably inadvertently created a torus or a torsion or a vortex. They might have inadvertently, using rotating magnetic fields, created a vortex. And the idea was, what if that vortex opened up a hole in space-time? That's the basic story. And hey, what if, and then there were movies about it and like the fucking movie where the Navy guy goes into the future, blah, blah, blah. I will say that everything about going backwards in time at this point is deeply theoretical. The one other thing I would mention before we go about going backwards, if it's been proven, let's see. We're going to talk about Einstein Rosen bridges and then we'll close out. Mm-hmm. Some people will say that what happened is that during the Philadelphia experiment, they inadvertently create a wormhole. And so, what's his name? You know, the guy that was he was dying of that debilitating disorder. And he's
Stephen Hawking,
famous physicist. Yeah.
Oh boy. That guy.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's not enough time for me to go in on him.
I'm going to leave it. Let me deal with it real quick.
Okay.
He did believe you could achieve time travel using wormholes. He also believed, I think, that you couldn't really. Here's what you could do. You could create an anchor point right now. Like, I'm going to create an anchor. I'm going to spin up my super energy system, and I'm going to create a wormhole anchor. But what you can't do is move it backwards. So, like, let's say I create an anchor in the past to February the 4th, 2020. And this is my anchor point, okay? As long as I can keep that wormhole intact, anybody that goes through that wormhole will go back to February the 4th, 2020. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
However, according to Hawking, you can't move that anchor point backwards in time. You can fix it when you're at some moment in time and say, here you go, this is going to be the magical place people can visit. But what you can't do is go back to Hitler's time and say, oh, there's the anchor point. According to Hawking, you have to build the anchor point. You can't just make it arrive there. Does that make sense?
It should be like Groundhog Day. Had Bill Murray built the anchor point ahead of time.
Actually, it would be like Groundhog Day with one exception. If you keep going through the wormhole, you're still going to age. You know, the thing about Bill Murray is he doesn't really age. He experiences this, but he doesn't necessarily get older. If you keep going through this wormhole, you're still going to age. You're still going to get older. It's just that you're going to have the ability to revisit this moment anytime you want to.
Would the people be aging every time? You know, he wanted to try to bang that girl.
And the other thing, too, is this is kind of a problem because you would be going back to the past. So basically, the greater the distance, like let's say you create this wormhole and the distance between A and B, A is the anchor point and B is the point in the future. The distance is only a few days. Well, whatever. I mean, next podcast, we're going to talk about maybe how fuzzy the now is. So maybe it's no big deal if you fuck around.
Ooh, interesting. I like that now comment. That's one of my favorite things.
We'll get into it, right?
Next time.
But what if the distance between the anchor point A, the entry point B, is 100 years?
Ooh, I got a window more than just a day.
Now all of a sudden, the kinds of things you can do become catastrophic. Like, it's not just that, because like, if I go back to yesterday, what the fuck can I do to fuck up today? I mean, I don't know, maybe I could do a couple things, but truly, if all I can do is go back to yesterday, or better yet, 5 minutes ago, if all I can do is go back 5 minutes, what truly catastrophic thing am I likely to trigger?
It's not too many things you can interact with in 5 minutes.
Right. So anyways, I'm not saying you have to buy into Hawking, dude. I mean, we can have a whole nother podcast.
Oh, that's fun, though. I like this.
But yeah, according to him, going backwards in time is theoretically possible if you have a fixed anchor point for the wormhole, okay? Which you will have, okay? You'll have a fixed anchor point in space-time. A lot of people actually believe that if wormholes existed, they would always have a fixed anchor point on both sides in a way. Probably on both sides. It's either fixed in space or fixed in space and time. This is a very controversial subject, dude, because wormholes have not been proven to exist. Okay. They are totally theoretical. You know, it's like talking about, it's like we said. I mean, the only things they claim that they've proven is that you can go forward in time faster, and that's time dilation. But they haven't proven anything else. So you got to take the Einstein-Rosenbridge wormhole thing with a grain of salt. Right?
Yes. And it's always fun to discuss and think about what is possible, not possible, because then you can slide into the things like the Mandela effect or the metaphysical, which we'll get to next time. And what if these are analogies that they're giving us of what is possible with our consciousness to be able to communicate that people claim to have done, can't be proven. So it gives me ideas. It's like the way you read Zero Hedge and you know that it's not all true, but you correlate the lies. So I love to hear theories, even if I don't think it's been proven or possible, from even Stephen Hawking, because I think they drop truth in there as well, just like they do on Zero Hedge. So you got to correlate that and come away with your own conclusions.
And you know what? Here's a really weird thought to leave with, right? I'm going to leave you with a very, very fucked up thought related to the Mandela effect.
Mm-hmm.
What if, and this is so fucked up, and there's no answer. This is something we can all think about and get really fucking fucked up, stressed about, but
Dan, that's not the show. Wait.
I'm kidding. I know, but what if, dude? What if they can go backwards in time, but they have caused so much damage that's why people are experiencing dementia and they're experiencing Alzheimer's and they're forgetting things? What if they'd gone backwards in time and they fucked things up so bad that the present and the future are horribly damaged? It's like
almost as good as the monkey herpes you left us with on.
I'm gonna call it, dude. Cosmological cancer. Like, they've gone back and they've fucked with the causality chain so much, it's like causing mutation in the body. What if all this Mandela effect shit and other stuff is basically cancer at a cosmological scale, damage to the fundamental nature of the universe that is replicating itself? And one of the effects is people are forgetting shit or misremembering.
That's interesting. And that they have the ability to do that would say that they could slide back and forth, I would assume, if you go back.
This is why I'm mentioning this, because I believe that there's one timeline. So I personally think there is no way to go back and change things. However, if you could, it would probably have horrific effects.
Yes, and that was one of our top, the grandfather.
Yeah. We're going to talk about it.
We'll get to that. Yeah.
We went a little over our hour. That's okay. We got to the first two points. We kind of expected that might happen. Thanks a lot, AJ, for joining us. And we're going to do this so you guys know every week until we get through this outline. And then from now on, I think this is how AJ and I are going to handle stuff like this. You know, just try to put together a good outline of subjects related to something and go with it. But this has been a good discussion. We have more discussions on time travel to come in the weeks ahead. And last but not least, if you listen to this podcast and you enjoy it, there will be links to Venmo and PayPal in the description of this podcast. There will also always be links to Venmo and PayPal on the SoundCloud homepage, which you can get to through iamsully.com. And if you donate enough money, we will send you a herpes monkey. We will send you a herpes monkey in a box. AJ will capture it.
Yeah. Yes.
And he'll ship it to you. You know, cash on delivery, though. Cash on delivery. Who wants to buy a herpes monkey?
Yeah. There's a lot of potential there. I'm telling you. Oh, Dan, I just got a text that we have a special guest on the next show, confirmed, booked. Glimbus 12 will be on part two.
Time traveling.
Yes. I just got word. So everyone's going to be really excited.
Oh boy, if Glimbus 12 visits us, then this is going to probably be pretty bad. But you know what? I think you're right. I think before we talk about what the now is at the beginning of the next one on time travel, we need to have Glimbus talk to us about his experiences with that bullshit, right?
Yeah, he's probably in the future. So it's perfect. He's there. All right. Thank you, Dan, for having me on. It was interesting and fun as always. So always enjoy speaking with you. Have a great afternoon.
You too.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.